This is Audible.
Christian Audio presents An Intentional Life, a life-giving invitation to uncover your passions and unlock your purpose. Written and read by Karen Stott. For Isaac, because you never stopped fighting. Introduction. Do you ever ache for more? I know, me too. And it feels strange to say this isn't enough when so much that surrounds me is exactly what I've been praying for. Or the fact that we have so much more available to us than many people around the world do. All of those thoughts make this nagging ache all the more complicated. Yet this isn't a contentment problem. That's an entirely different battle. This is about heart, about calling. This is about that angst in your soul that's been nagging you most of your life. Sometimes whispering, sometimes shouting. It's been there on repeat, and it creates a lingering, almost haunting dream that I can only describe as the voice and heart of God. The tugs can come from anything, but they always pull you in the same direction. Towards justice, invention, art, the human body, dance, building things, teaching things, fighting for things. Whatever it is for you, it's woven deep, and trying to change it or fight it feels like waging war on your own soul. But what can you even do about it? Everywhere I go, I hear people asking about it, wanting to discover it, and trying to figure out how to find it. This calling, this elusive purpose. But in watching my own life unfold and observing literally thousands of others through leading the pursuit community, I've realized this it we are searching for is probably more basic than we even realize. It's never been about the aha moment, the arrival. You don't just wake up one day and realize you've made it. A calling isn't a destination, it's a lifestyle. It's simply responding to His invitation with one more step of faith, one more surrender, one more yes. For years, I knew that God was asking me to tell my story. I resisted, as I almost always do at first. I told Him that He had the wrong girl, and He would have to wait until I finished with the demanding, mothering of little stages before I ever committed to writing a book. But yet again, God's plans trumped my own. Within 6 months of telling a friend I would never write a book while I had young children at home, I found myself signing papers and agreeing to do just that. Just one more invitation from my loving Father. One more yes from me. Maybe you find yourself in a similar space today, wanting to move forward with a new career, a dream, a proposed opportunity, a new city, or even a possible relationship. Maybe you're a busy mama juggling several mouths to feed, the never-ending needs of marriage, and all that goes into keeping a home, all while wondering what happened to the girl under all those roles. Maybe you don't have a dream yet and wonder if God will ever use you, or you think you've screwed up too big, or failed too much, or lost too much to keep going. Maybe the battle you're fighting is seeing Him in the mundane, everyday moments as you wait for Him to answer your thousandth prayer for the same thing. Maybe you've lost your joy or your purpose or your reason to get out of bed every morning and you just need to know it will all be okay. But how? What's next? How do you start over or move forward? How do you smile again when things have gone so horribly wrong or your life doesn't reflect what you thought it would be by this time in your life? Friend, you're in the right place. I've been there too. Still am in some cases, and I chose to say yes to writing these pieces of my story with you in mind. I had massive fears about writing this book and stepping out into a much bigger arena than I'm used to. I didn't really want to share my story or take the cover off of my messy bits, but friend, that is based in fear. Fear of what people will think, fear of failing my family by spending time on this project, fear of saying something in these chapters that will hurt someone or confuse someone or make someone write bad things about me. But you know what stopped fear in those tracks? You know what cast it out as far as the east is from the west? Love. In 1 John 4:18, we're told that perfect love drives out fear. Someone once explained this to me in a way that finally made sense. When you truly love someone, fear vanishes. Your love for them pushes down the fears of what could happen to you in light of the good that could unfold in their lives. And that's what got me here today. I have such a deep love for helping others live free and purpose-filled lives that my measly fears of stepping out in this way are diminished. And if writing these words and telling my story can be an avenue of help, it's worth every bit. Consider this audiobook your love letter, your field guide, and if needed, your wake-up call to the life you've always wanted. A life where your passions are ignited, purpose fills your every breath and action, and you can rest fully, presently, and joyfully in the abundant life God has for you. So grab your cold glass of sweet tea or coffee in your favorite mug and take my hand. Let's adventure together and uncover the greatness behind those beautiful eyes of yours. For you hold more power and wonder and impact than you even know. And the world and your legacy are waiting to watch you live your most meaningful and intentional life. Forever in your corner, Karen. Chapter 1. It's a setup. Living with purpose means wisely choosing and committing to a few of the best things for the season of life you're in. Crystal Payne. I'm not sure where the lie began or when I bit off on it. As a girl raised in the church my entire life, I should have been better versed in the concepts of scripture and what God really says about women. But somewhere between the flannel graphs on Sunday mornings and the gospel according to me, my view of what it meant to be a Christian woman got terribly turned around. My mother worked my entire life. She has her master's degree in education and spent more than 40 years serving the children in our community as an elementary school teacher. Growing up, my brothers and I spent many evenings huddled around the coffee table, cutting shapes from giant sheets of laminated plastic for her classroom lessons the following week. We spent summers helping her organize her classroom and took care of the baby chicks that hatched under the incubator lights over spring break. We were so blessed to be able to be very involved in her work, and even more blessed that she shared our schedule so we could have holidays and summer breaks off together. Before her, my grandmother was an active member of the local BPW, Business and Professional Women's Foundation, in our tiny Mayberry-like town. I remember going to meetings with her and watching her volunteer at the festivals downtown wearing her adorable blue vest with yellow pins. Despite the culture of the 1940s, where the primary place for women was within the walls of her home, my grandma worked proudly as a secretary for the school and other local businesses. What escapes my understanding is how, with such a strong family heritage of working women, my view of this lifestyle became so distorted. Negative, even. It pains me to say this because it's so embarrassing, but I started to look at women who worked with pity and, honestly, a wee bit of disdain. As my life unfolded and I observed the women in my life doing their things, and then I became a wife and mother doing my own, my warped perspective put God in a box, and since I had placed him in a box, I lived in one too. When we take our own limitations and put them on the God who set the planets in orbit, it chains us to a life limited to our own power. Our lack of faith, in turn, hinders the way we see him and the way he shows up in our lives. From a young age, I remember always and only ever wanting to be a wife and mom. There were brief blanks in my history where I wanted to be a marine life trainer or an interior decorator or a veterinarian. But in the end, my heart settled on home and the dreams of building my own when I grew up. Until one day, I woke up right in the middle of this dream I'd forged for myself. And all of a sudden, it didn't feel like everything I thought it would. I was 23, 4 years into a marriage with the man of my dreams. We had just built our first house, and I was holding the most beautiful sight I'd ever seen, our firstborn, Ava. Everything was perfect, blissful even. It was all I'd ever dreamed of, and I was aware enough to know that I was blessed enough to be living in it. Yet something inside me still ached, and I found myself longing to find a creative outlet in addition to my new role of motherhood. I must give pause here to mention that I believe with my whole heart that motherhood is a beautiful and highly purpose-filled mission. Being a stay-at-home mama is the hardest job I've ever done, and the time women spend sowing into their families is priceless and dripping with potential fruit. I've had the blessing of juggling things in this work-at-home circus for almost 13 years now, and I truly, truly love it. I find the family rhythms, mundane tasks, mountaintop victories, and praying through the hard times together to be truly magical. But for the sake of this story, I want to focus on the area of motherhood that plagued me with guilt and robbed me of so much joy for nearly 5 years. The lie that doing anything outside of the home and caring about anything other than my family was selfish, disrespectful, and even a waste of time. Sadly, the church I called home at the time reinforced those walls and actually helped build them higher. Instead of celebrating the beauty and possibility of how multifaceted and talented women are, they chose to teach that my only calling was to be a mom and a wife. In their eyes, I was to have children, do volunteer work with the church, attend MOPS, have more children, make more dinners, wipe more bums, clean up more toys, and repeat this cycle until I had raised Jesus-loving, obedient young adults who followed the path they'd laid out for them. End of story. In that church's world, there was no room for freedom or dreams or guiding our children into being responsible, mature humans who lived unhindered lives of passion and purpose as they followed God's call and walked in their gifts. They were all about following a specific, predictable path. And for women, that meant marriage, children, and ministry within the walls of that specific church. As time went on, something about this picture didn't sit well in the deep places of my heart. I just couldn't shake it. If that church's teachings were true, what would happen to me when my kids moved out of the house? What did this mean for women who were never able to have children of their own? What about Sarah in the Bible? Did she have no purpose or calling before she had Isaac in her 90s? What about all the dreams I had that weren't specifically tied to motherhood? I started to feel completely at odds inside. Was I crazy, selfish, or worse, unable to hear God? The more I questioned, the more ostracized I became in my church community. The people I was surrounded with at that time in my life didn't understand my longing for something completely different, and they would openly criticize me for not being completely fulfilled in my motherly duties. And worse, they would tell me often that I was being rebellious against God's perfect will if I didn't follow a specific path they believed was right for me. Now please hear me, dear listener. If we had the privilege of sitting down to share a cup of coffee, and most likely some berry-laden pastry, you'd see the fullness of my heart pouring out about this subject. I adore my kids, head over heels. I'll love you forever, squeeze their cheeks off, obsessed with them. And I truly, truly love getting to stay at home and raise them. My heart beats for it, through and through. But even though I loved my day-in, day-out mama duties, there was still something inside me, something deeper, that wouldn't go away. And trust me, I tried to make it go away by ignoring it and stuffing it down. But it kept coming back up. It was like this deep knowing, almost longing, that God had something else for me, in addition to motherhood, that he had created me to do. Eventually, these longings, these passions, if you will, led me to open my own business as a photographer. But the more successful I became in my business, the more unsupported and lonely I felt in my church community. The same friends who were there for me in my journey of motherhood disappeared when it came to the other passions of my heart, and I started to feel as though I was living two different lives. With their words and comments, they continued to build the box around me, stronger this time. They wanted to keep me normal, to keep me tidy. I was encouraged to follow God, but only in the directions they had laid out for me, and only within the walls of their church. They had convinced me that they could hear God's will for our life better than we could, and for too long, we believed them. Don't worry, friend. I know this now to be very dangerous territory and completely unhealthy, and we are no longer under this church leadership, but I didn't know any of that back then. Despite the opposition I was receiving from my church, my wild dreamer heart and stubborn tomboy grit just couldn't bite off on it. I knew there was more to this story, more to my story, and I know there's more to yours too. I remember struggling with my quiet times back then because I felt so judged and on the outs with most people, even God. But a sweet friend of mine encouraged me to start small and press through. She said just a little time in God's word each day would be life-changing. And it was. She recommended I commit to reading one chapter of Proverbs a day for a whole month, so I did. As I got to the last day of the challenge and read through the words of Proverbs 31, my entire world changed. This was not the story I'd been told my entire life. How had I never read this before? How come no one told me? Or worse, how could I have missed this? What kind of Christian was I? The words felt like a lightning bolt of truth, passion, and purpose, sending shockwaves through my soul and igniting my insides. This is it, I remember thinking. This explains everything. She considers a field and buys it. Out of her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her tasks. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies the merchants with sashes. She is clothed with strength and dignity. She can laugh at the days to come. She speaks with wisdom, and faithful instruction is on her tongue. She watches over the affairs of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children arise and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Proverbs 31:16-17 and 24-28. I remember staring at the words in disbelief, jaws open, eyes trying to regain focus to read them again. This has been in the Bible the entire time, I thought. Why, then, was I being taught something so different? In an instant, everything that had been so confusing for so long suddenly made sense. The war I had been fighting within my own soul was finished. I kept reading it again and again as the truth of those verses washed over my heart. Her children arise and call her blessed. Her husband also. I almost couldn't believe what I was reading. This woman, whom God made sure to talk about in his word, obviously loved her family. She got up early and cooked their food, made their clothes, watched over them, and instructed them faithfully. But it was the other part that got to me. It was the other part that sent me into a tailspin of unlearning more than a decade of false beliefs. This woman was such an incredible mother and wife. Scripture makes sure to depict her as such. But beyond her roles within her home, she was a savvy, smart, strong, and wise businesswoman. She bought property and started a vineyard, and she designed and sold clothing, all without the help of modern-day machinery, electricity, or Apple products, I might add. It makes me tired just thinking of it. But then, this is where it gets crazy, friend. But then she laughed. She was happy. She was without fear. She was balanced. Everything taken care of. Nothing neglected. And with all of that going on, her family still praised her. I felt overwhelming peace and brand new excitement soak into the deep places of my soul. Ancient words coming alive in my heart thousands of years after they were penned. As a lover of words and story and helping others, I took to sharing what had just been revealed to me on my blog. I had started my blog for my photography business. It was an easy way to share the stories of my clients, gain web traffic to get new clients, and showcase my work. But I never considered talking about my personal life on there. It was more of a rotating portfolio updated with new images than anything close to sharing about my actual life. But something happened to me that day that I can't explain, and I just had to write it. I had to share it. As I poured my heart onto those pages of my blog, a strange and unexpected thing happened. My story began to take on its own life. Apparently, my photography clients weren't the only ones reading my blog after all. I watched the comments on my posts explode into the most beautiful conversation among women from all across the globe. As I read through the comments, my story came echoing back to me through the lenses of others' lives. And all of us began to realize we weren't as alone as we thought we were. I never imagined that one post would change the entire course of my life. But that's what can happen when God whispers and we walk. Absolutely anything is possible. As things like this often go, one thing led to the next, and soon, without meaning to or even realizing what was happening, I had somehow started a ministry for women juggling babes and businesses. Pursuit seemed like a fitting name, because what brought us together was our pursuit of the callings God had placed on our lives. This was about the pursuit of doing it His way, where our children and our husbands and other relationships were honored and He was glorified. There were 17 of us when we started, and within months there were more than 500. My friend Kara asked if she could start a Northern California pursuit group to connect with women in her area, and just like that, the floodgates opened. Within the next few years, we were hosting sold-out conferences, managing hundreds of groups all over the globe, and providing biblically-centered encouragement and practical business help to more than 25,000 Christian entrepreneurial women around the world. And it all started because I said yes and stepped out to share my story. Looking back at how it all unfolded, I'm still baffled. And every time I talk about it, I'm still shocked that God chose a massively introverted tomboy who grew up in a town of 1,500 people to lead a women's ministry where everyone but me seemed to have it together. But that's how amazing God is. He takes the pieces of our stories that seem like setbacks, and He uses them as the foundation to set others free. Looking back at the last 7 years, I'm beginning to see that pursuit was birthed more because of God's pursuit of me than mine of Him. As much as I wish that was different, we humans rank rather high on the selfish scale, and I've come to find that His desire to lift the daughters in this generation to a new level of freedom, passion, and influence trumps my pursuit of just about anything. So I find myself praying that we can be a society of sledgehammers. I want to break the walls that the world, unbiblical religion, and even our own traditional beliefs try to build around God's daughters. I want to shatter the shackles placed on women that hold them back from becoming all God has created them to be. Many women have been oppressed and made to feel guilty for chasing their dreams and missing out on family time. Or on the flip side, staying at home and being judged for missing out on the outside world. It's as though we as women can't win either way, and I want to help change that. I want to be a launching pad for this generation to rise up and walk boldly into the fullness of their calling God has placed on their breathtakingly beautiful heads, both in the home and around the globe. And I want to take as many people with me as I can. Are you in? Chapter 2. Tears. I always wondered why somebody didn't do something about that. Then I realized I am somebody. Anonymous. Almost everything I find myself doing now was once something I never imagined doing. God is like that more often than we think. He woos us into our calling through our very own cries. Sometimes He brings us to a place of such raw desperation that we can no longer sit silent. We must act. We must do something. Anything. Because it feels that we are forsaking our own souls to not do something. But almost without fail, the forward comes after the fall. Sometimes, dare I say every time, we must go through our own hurts before we can really hold any authority. I think that's why He allows us to walk through things we never would have written in our own life plan. God wants our stories to take a role in our own healing. Sometimes He allows us to process through and triumph over pain so that we can be the answer to someone else's prayer. Think of all the nonprofits out there, the ministries, the campaigns. They all began because of a burden. A problem that somebody had, a need begging to be fixed, a hole needing to be filled. Someone, somewhere, held a hunch that another soul probably shared the same struggle. And just like that, a company was born, or a product was made, or a movement was started. Our tears often tell us which way to go or what to do if we only stop long enough to listen. Your passion, that thing that echoes through your mind and is constantly drawing you in relentlessly, it may not even have a point or a destination or any real mission that you can make sense of in the beginning. But still, you can't seem to go against the grain of your own heart and resist it, whatever it may be. We need to trust that our tears mean something, that God put them there for a reason and is pressing his finger harder and harder on that sweet spot until we wake up and give it attention that he wants it to have. We need to press into it to do something, because chances are high that someone out there is waiting for you to step out, to start, to share your story or come up with a solution or create a place for them to belong. Whatever it is you are waiting to step out in, remember there are faces and names and stories just waiting for you to do that thing. Because when you do, you'll end up being a tangible answer to someone's prayer. Chapter 3. Seeds. We worry far too much about outcomes instead of focusing on inputs. We cannot make things grow, period. All we can do is plant and water. But if we plant and water, God promises to give the increase. Mark Batterson. Gathering for a meal takes me back to all the good places in my heart and reminds me of the person I want to be. These times around the table together seem to feed my soul more than my belly. They always have. Maybe it's my country roots and the memories of how growing up, we were one of the very few families I knew that ate together every night. Maybe it's the whipping about and bumping into each other in the kitchen that was too small for all five of us to work together that made it so special. Or singing with my brothers afterwards as we did our part in the wash-dry-put-away cycle. Maybe it's the conversations that unfold and the things we learn about each other when we make a point to silence the world and sit face to face, the good bits and the ugly ones. Maybe it's the candlelight and the swirl of yummy smells that fill the air. Maybe it's one of those things that fills me in the deep places and makes me feel fully alive. Maybe it's all of them. The older I've become, the more I've started to unveil the deeper, truer sources of this longing for fellowship around the table. This time of family, of connection, of showing up and loving well is so vital to my happiness that I've realized it's been specifically woven into my being by the hands that formed me. I believe we long for this time to sit and celebrate in togetherness because our Father in heaven created us that way. We serve a God who passionately loves family and kinship and celebration. Based on what I've gathered from Scripture, I imagine the first 30 years of Jesus' life to have been filled with a large focus on family, togetherness, and friendships. According to Luke 3:23, Jesus didn't begin public ministry until the age of 30. It seems to me God intentionally rooted Jesus in love, family, relationship, togetherness, and in just being before calling him into ministry. So if God put so much emphasis on this area of Jesus' life on earth, why don't we? Family is the heartbeat of who God is. Why else would he use family terms to describe Jesus and us? Why else would a dinner with his community be the last thing Jesus did on earth before heading to the garden to be arrested? Why would a wedding feast be among the top heavenly priorities as we step into eternity? I think it's because there's significance in the savoring, a blessing in the being. No rushing, nowhere else to go. Just stopping for a brief piece of our days to show up, sit down, and see into the eyes of the ones we love. When I think about these things, I can't get over how much God loves us. The King of all kings is even now preparing a seat for his children at his table. What an honor. What an incredible gift for the King to plan such a feast for us. As I look back, I realize that in so many ways, the table has made me who I am and helped me find my purpose. I think we all know what it feels like to be welcomed in and to be left out. At some point in our lives, we've probably all walked onto a bus or into a crowded room or cafeteria or a new job and experienced instant fear. Do I belong here? Is there really a place for me? Will I be all alone? Not belonging is a real intangible fear. We all want to have a seat at the table, to fit in, to be thought of, to be seen. I believe that's why God placed a deep burden on my heart to gather people and give them a place of belonging. A place where numbers and followers and successes and failures don't matter, but beautiful hearts, ambiance, and conversations do. I dream of a day when every person can rest in the security that they matter more than they can even comprehend. And I pray you can comprehend that for your own heart too. You were created for a purpose greater than you could ever know. There is room enough at the table for you. not just because there is physical space, but because you, specifically, fill a hole that no one else can. And your presence, you, showing up and taking up that space, is the only way to make it whole again. That is the kind of world I want and the type of safe haven I work hard at cultivating. As we were planning the activities for one of our conferences a few years ago, I had this incredible vision of a long white table overlooking the water. It had gold chargers, beautiful flowers, high-back chairs, and a seat for every woman there. I immediately followed this thought by emailing the coordinator at the retreat center and proposing the idea. Because, as we've talked about, the incessant whirling around of an idea seems often to be, in my case, God's invitation into action. I knew that they had never done this before, and I was sort of asking for a miracle. After all, setting up a near football field length table, bringing more than 200 wooden chairs outdoors, and redirecting an entire kitchen staff to transport and set up food at the bottom of the hillside would be quite a feat. But something nudged me just to ask. I couldn't shake the thought that going severely out of my way to prepare a place for women to feel pampered and loved was an investment worth the effort. So I pressed on. I typed out every detail of my vision, complete with a design board I'd created with decor photos so they could really get the visual. I pressed send and waited anxiously. It wasn't long before I received a reply, and to my surprise, the staff was actually entertaining it. I couldn't believe it. Over the course of the next few months, we worked out every detail of what we started to call the Art of Community Celebration. And the very best part, we didn't tell the conference attendees a thing. The thought of surprising them in such a grand way made me giddy from the inside out. And when I start feeling that way, I know I've somehow uncovered a golden sweet spot of what I was made to do. I desperately wanted to create a special time of slowing down and coming together that would remind us all of the goodness God has for us. This fast-paced world makes it apparent that we all need a little more of that kind of time in our lives. To pause long enough to watch a sunset, to love well, to linger a bit longer. Time to just be. Not striving or longing or complaining or competing or even doing. Just being. Those are the times our souls come fully alive. When we let go long enough to take a deep breath, to belly laugh at a good story, and to soak in the energy that comes from being around amazing people. But all of that is increasingly being lost in our go, do, hustle, conquer culture. And since these entrepreneurial women were well acquainted with a life of busy and pressure and striving, I wanted to give them permission to embrace and savor the magic as it unfolded without the pressures of performing and doing anything at all. I hoped and prayed that after giving them a little taste, a little glimpse of the glory held in this kind of intentional community, the women would love it enough to take it home and cultivate it there too. The pages of the calendar turned, and the night finally came. I slipped into my navy dress with coral flowers, wrapped my hair in a topknot, and made my way down the hill overlooking the water to make the last-minute preparations. As I straightened chairs and chargers and placed sprigs of eucalyptus as a table runner down the center, I can honestly say that with every place setting and piece of greenery I touched, I felt a little closer to our Father's heart. I walked up and down the table, setting out glasses, tying napkins, touching the back of each chair, and praying for each person as I went. Each place for someone indescribably special, someone loved beyond comprehension. I could almost picture Jesus doing the same thing, walking up and down the wedding feast table, knowing already who would fill each seat, and excitedly waiting to unite with us, to hug us close. As I made last-minute touch-ups and counted down the minutes until the women arrived, I prayed they'd feel it, tangibly. I prayed that as they came around the corner and saw what was set before them, they would get a little glimpse of God's heart for them, and even more so, that they would be overwhelmed by it. I wanted them to know that what He has prepared is incomprehensibly more amazing. I prayed in the deepest parts of who they are that they would know that at His table, they would always have a place where they truly belong. As I finished tying bows around napkins, I looked up to see a few hundred women coming out from behind the white brick retaining wall. It was the kind of wall you might see in an old European village, tall, regal, curving with a pathway with chipping off white paint revealing the red clay below. As the women rounded the corner, face after face lit up in a beautiful meshing of delight and disbelief, highlighted by the glow of the setting sun on their skin. I heard gasps and whispers and watched several women grab their own faces in awe. Others let tears escape from their eyes and fall silently down their cheeks. The whispers turned to a hushed silence as they came down the hill and made their way to the table. I got a chance to talk to many of the women that night, and I cried during almost every conversation. I can't even tell you when I last paused to watch a sunset, one said. No one has ever done something so extravagant for me, so lavish. But one woman's comment stopped me in my tracks and became engraved in my soul. With tears streaming down her face, she stopped me and said, I feel like God did all of this for me. I feel like he is romancing me tonight. Thank you. I was so stunned I didn't know what to say, but before I could stop the words from jumping out of my mouth, I simply said, he did. God did it all for you. And I truly believe he may have. This is what happens when we give roots to the seeds God has planted in our hearts. They are in all of us, every single one, and they hold power to change courses, speak life, and truly change a life. No one is immune to the plans of God. Those seemingly insignificant little inklings that are embedded in your soul were placed there on purpose. And they are anything but insignificant. They are seeds. They hold the capacity of life itself within their hard shells, but require the obedience of the caretaker and the right environment and surrounding to properly nourish them into their full potential. This dinner, this table, this opportunity to partner with God to romance his daughters was a seed in the form of an inkling, a nudge, a burning desire. A seed I took, beheld, and decided to water to see what would come of it. Over the years, I've encountered thousands of women and had hundreds of conversations that have all seemed to start with a simple seed, a God idea. And it made me wonder something. What is your seed? What is the idea that keeps nagging you, the dream that keeps you up at night? What is the maybe I should that is coming to your mind right now? Whether it's the urge to write, move, bring justice to a situation, start a nonprofit, learn another language, or bring a meal to your neighbor. It all starts with a seed that holds more possibility and power than you can comprehend. And you owe it to yourself and to the God who planted it there to pay attention, give it some water, and take the first step toward bringing that seed to life. Chapter 4. Connect the dots. Often the answer to our prayers does not come while we are on our knees, but while we are on our feet, serving the Lord and serving those around us. Theodor Uchtdorf. I'm not used to being a cool kid. Growing up, I was often the last one picked for a team during middle school intramurals, and I was most definitely the senior who was failing chemistry for the fourth consecutive time. I wasn't a child scholar or voted the most likely to succeed, but I did have my own accolades to fill up my childhood scrapbooks. I had a fierce passion for justice and loving the underdog. I was voted most huggable, and I could fill a small safe with competitive swimming medals. But even so, I always felt like the black sheep of our small town. Labels always confused me, and cliques made me crazy. It seemed my life was one giant contradiction. I was a loner artist, and I was also part of the popular group of girls that paraded themselves around in matching jackets. I was in student council, and I also spent many afternoons in detention. I was a leader of campus life, and I skipped more than half of my junior year of school. Boxes never worked for me. And when conformity was pushed down my throat, the only thing that resulted was depression and more rebellion. I never realized it back then, but I think something beautifully profound resulted from my stubborn adolescent ways. I learned that life and people don't always have to be one way or another. It's completely okay to be both and. I don't think the God who sets the planets in orbit and imagined everything from the peony to the narwhal would want anything less than for each of us to leave our own unique mark on the world. I can be both the country gal in boots and the executive in heels. I can be both smitten in love and positively furious with the same man. I can be lost in the dream of a big picture and get caught up in the details. I think there's something insanely special about those of us who break the mold. The ones who say yes to crazy invitations and follow God into the scary things that don't make much natural sense. Don't you? Growing up in rural America, I was surrounded with patterns and small town normal. We were a farming community where activities loosely followed the harvest schedule and hunting season. We had one stoplight for most of my life, and I can still remember the grand opening of McDonald's, which was like the president had come to town. I could hear the roar of the Friday night football games and the blare of the announcer from my front yard. I walked the same high school halls as some of my grandparents and knew all of the founding families of our quaint little town. And who am I kidding? Ours was one of them. Families stayed, new generations took over old farms, and the cycle continued. My mom would often call me up and tell me she had another student who was the child of one of her former students. In these spaces, the both and rears its head again. The same things that can make me feel blissfully nostalgic are the very things that make me want to pull out my own hair. My friends applied for colleges and mapped out their 5 and 10 year plans. But as someone who barely finished high school, borrowing a ton of money just to dump into a college education I didn't even want hardly seemed like the wisest choice. So while my friends panicked about SATs, I hid away in the dark room creating pure magic with baths of chemicals and a red light. As they typed cover letters and resumes, I sat on the oversized rocks by the soccer field and pinned strings of syllables together on yellow tablets of paper. Steve Jobs once said, "You can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards." So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in the future. You have to trust something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. For the sake of this narrative, I'm going to rework that last sentence. You have to trust something, your gut, your inklings, your unquenchable passions, your burdens, your tears, for they may be the very whispers of God. It's hard to detect when you're in the throes of it, but the things that keep you up at night just might be your life's greatest purpose, or at the very least, an invitation to help you discover what is. Many of my friends who stressed about SATs and had perfect GPAs have gone on to be incredible executives in major cities around the world. Their teenage inklings to take studying seriously and work hard on their test led them into what they were made to do. As a 17-year-old shooting still life photos of stuffed animals, I certainly didn't foresee a career as a professional photographer, but that's exactly what unfolded years later. Similarly, when I hid away, writing poems under the bleachers at school, I never dreamed that writing would be a part of my actual paying job. At times it feels as though God has invited us to join him on the great scavenger hunt that is our life. Along the way, he's hidden clues in our past about who we are, what we light up for, and why we are here. Yet it isn't until we are much further along in the journey, having collected quite a few clues, that we are able to start making sense of where he might be going and what it all might mean. And yet the fullness of it will remain a mystery until the day when we will stand with him in glory to replay it all. I'm baffled that so many of us spend so much time trying to decode a calling that we might never fully understand the side of heaven. It's all a walk of faith. And I think it's a whole lot less complicated than people are making it out to be these days. All we can really do is go about our business, pick up the clues as they come, read them, notice them, steward them, reflect on them, and then keep following the Holy Spirit's lead until God reveals the next one to us. It reminds me of a story about one of my favorite Bible guys, Moses. One day while Moses was taking care of the sheep and goats of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, he led the flock across the desert and came to Sinai, the holy mountain. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him as a flame coming from the middle of the bush. When the Lord saw that Moses was coming closer, he called to him from the middle of the bush and said, "Moses, Moses." He answered, "Yes, here I am." Exodus 3:1-4. One of the things I love so much about this story is that Moses is in the middle of his daily duties of tending sheep. He wasn't sitting inactive, stressing about what God wanted him to do with his life. He wasn't chasing and striving and trying to do the next big thing or be noticed by those around him. He was simply living his life and being a good steward of what God had given him to take care of in that season. And in the middle of a regular day, while he was doing his everyday tasks, God showed up in the most unexpected way with a glorious interruption. The important thing to notice here is that when God spoke, Moses was listening. And he didn't just listen. He engaged in the conversation. He picked up the clue. He did the next thing. He was both and. Moses was both a good steward and open to new adventures. He was afraid and willing to step out. He was a small town shepherd and a leader of thousands. Reading this story all the way to the end in one sitting makes it feel like Moses would be foolish not to go where God said. I mean, obviously everything is going to be okay, and Moses is about to be set up as one of the greatest faith stories in the history of the Bible. But it isn't that simple. He didn't get to read the story. He had to walk in it, blindly. Moses didn't know the outcome. He just heard the invitation. And the best part about it? God already had an answer to every excuse and a solution to every problem Moses would come up with. In the form of his brother Aaron and the stick in his hand, Moses had been given everything he needed to succeed at the journey God was setting before him. The intimacy of this story never escapes me. God, who spoke the world into being and breathed life into our bones, could have gone about this any way he wanted. He could have created armies from nothing and upgraded Moses' clothing to armor and staff to a sword. But he didn't. Instead, he shows up in the mundane, ordinary moments of Moses' day and invites him on the adventure of his life. For tools, God asks him to use only what he already has in his hands, his staff. For help, he can turn to someone with whom he already has a relationship, his brother Aaron. And I believe that is exactly what he wants to do with you and me. I would bet that Moses never imagined that the same staff he used every day to tend sheep would be the very tool God used to part literal seas and free an entire nation. In a similar way, as a 12-year-old obsessed with taking pictures and a high schooler on the newspaper and yearbook staff, it would never occur to me that those would be the very tools God would use to usher me into leading women around the world to new levels of freedom in their faith, family, and businesses. In both Moses' story and mine, God invaded our day-to-day routines to lead us into our destinies, using the tools we already held, the training we already had, and the relationships we were already in. He took what we had, asked us to step out in faith, and freed people through our footsteps of obedience. And if his character and patterns tell us anything, he wants to part waters in people's situations and free people from bondage using the tools and relationships you already have too, if you're willing to say yes to his invitation. Chapter 5. Stay. Couples who make it aren't the ones who never had a reason to get divorced. They are simply the ones who decided early on that their commitment to each other was always going to be bigger than their differences and flaws. Dave Willis. In this chapter, I'm describing a rough patch in my marriage. I was tempted to leave, but I knew staying was what I was called to do, and it's been a huge blessing. For some people, staying is not a safe option. If you're in an abusive situation, reach out to someone you trust and ask for help. When Isaac and I pledged our lives to each other, I was 19 and he was 21. We both grew up in the same tiny town and were headed to a completely new life 3,000 miles away on an Air Force base. We were young and smitten in love, and there was no way we could comprehend the magnitude of what we were getting into with this new life together across the country from everything we'd ever known. Last night, as Isaac played with my hair and sweet country melodies filled the quiet night air, I leaned in and whispered, "Babe, we've been together almost half my life. That's just crazy." "Crazy awesome," he said back. We lay there and let the truth of those words sink into our souls. "It is crazy awesome," I thought. In a culture obsessed with upgrades and updates, I wouldn't trade this long-lasting love for any amount of anything. There's something so sacred about the test of time and staying the course. At my grandpa's memorial, my grandma had some of her favorite quotes she'd collected over the years framed next to the coffee and cookies. I paused long and hard as my eyes made their way over the words and tears began to fill my eyes. Printed simply, on a sheet of bright pink copy paper, were these words. The question is asked, is there anything more beautiful in life than a boy and a girl clasping clean hands and pure hearts in the path of marriage? Can there be anything more beautiful than young love? And the answer is given, yes. There is a more beautiful thing. It is the spectacle of an old man and an old woman finishing their journey together on that path. Their hands are gnarled but still clasped. Their faces are seamed but still radiant. Their hearts are physically bowed and tired, but still strong with love and devotion for one another. Yes, there is a more beautiful thing than young love. Old love. It's only a few months from now that Isaac and I will celebrate 17 years of I do's. It feels like forever and yesterday wrapped in the same breath. And yet with all the roads we've walked and battles we've won, it's a mere glimpse of the deep truths those words hold. For those words written about old love are the secrets kept sacred for the warriors at the end of the battle, the ones tattered by time and frailed from one more load of laundry, one more shared meal, and one more act of forgiveness. It's the intimacy that only time, experience, trust, and endurance know. And I pray with all my might that I too will hold them as my own one day. Not even 2 decades in, and I can catch Isaac's eyes across the room and laugh with the knowledge of what's behind his grin. It's like a secret code I've only begun solving. One that has taken trials, time, and grace upon sweet grace to begin to decode and drive their children batty with curiosity. These are the treasures that come with endurance. The secret places revealed in hearts opened only by time and tending. You can't get there quickly, and you'll be scarred deeply along the way. Cut to more pieces than your formerly put-together self can dare to imagine. But as you walk through, broken, fragmented, ripped to shreds, you'll pick up pieces along the path you didn't know existed before. Pieces I can only imagine are what that poet spoke of in The Beauty of Old Love. Along that path, you'll find tenacity in your heart and grit in your spirit. You'll learn what it takes to get shoved deep into the muddy things of life and rise up with dirt in your hair and ashes on your face while still shining bright with joy. You'll find that the real strength and biggest freedoms come with shaking the mud off your skin and forgiving the one who forced you into the trenches in the first place. And most of all, you'll learn that grace wins. Every single time. You'll learn that it's the scars that make you stronger and that each one sings a victory song that will be heard for generations. Like the rings on a tree trunk cut open wide, the lines will be your legacy. It's the stories of losing it all and learning to rise again and again that will live longer than you do. And these tales of wrecked and rising are the prerequisite to truly experiencing the deep places of love. I don't know why I walked my entire Christian life without ever making this connection before. But as I find myself midway through my 36th trip around the sun, it feels as though I've been picked up, turned around, and placed on the other side of things. The way I see things now is different than before. Less romanticized, more raw, just the way I like it, if I'm being honest. This man I love, the one taking up life space and bed space and heart space, looks different now. And though his hands look rougher, his eyes are softer, kinder. A depth of grace and understanding floats between us that we never knew existed before. And our capacity for compassion is larger, too. Years ago, but not so long ago that I can't still taste it, I almost gave it all away. The enormity of hurt that had lodged itself between us was too much to bear in my own soul. Selfishness, pride, and buried frustrations gave birth to desires of sweet relief. Our years of miscommunication had gone on and had been ignored so long it became definitely silent and caused huge gaps in our marriage and wounds on our hearts. A new life, a life without him, teased me with convenience and freedom and ease. I daydreamed of packing it all up and driving away. Away so far that none of the pain could reach my doorstep, and the possibility that a new beginning would surely be the anecdote that would wipe away my bitter befores. But as a dreamer, something strange happened when I began to entertain the scenario and play it all out. When I paused long enough to notice the wake of what would be a certain catastrophic blow to all of our hearts, everything changed. I imagined what that aftermath would bring. I imagined the brokenness, the children's tears, my tears, all of our tears, really. I imagined two households, his and hers bedrooms and divided Christmases. The imaginations made my heart break into pieces, and seeing it all play out in my mind's eye stripped it of its allure. I'd seen too many lives play out this way, too many hearts crushed in the aftermath of hurt and unforgiveness. So since it was my daydream, I decided to change the story. And it turns out, changing the story changed absolutely everything. I pictured driving away and watching him out of my rearview mirror. I imagined the children's faces pressed up against the cold glass windows, fogged up and wet from tears. And I turned around. I changed the story in my mind. With the car barely parked, I ran out of the car and into his arms, and I chose to stay. Forgiveness and grace became my anthem that day. And Christmases together, with grandchildren underfoot, was the picture I held on to. The pain of all the hurt was still fresh, and to be honest, I didn't want to cave to forgiveness and open up to the possibility of being hurt again. But there's a richness that comes when life gives you every reason to go and you choose to stay anyway. It says, I see you, all of you, the beautifully put together and the brutally broken, and I still choose you. I will always choose you. And isn't that what we all want anyway? To be fully seen, fully known, and fully chosen? It is for me. It seems that society today isn't used to difficult things. Maybe that's why there are fewer marriages and babies being born percentage-wise than there were a century ago. Our quick-fix culture has band-aids for everything from hunger to shopping to finding love on the internet. The sacred journey of long and slow, waited and fought for, feels lost on this generation. So when life doesn't go as planned and we find ourselves desolate and depressed, it's easy to fall into the mindset that we did something wrong, that we are being punished, or that God simply doesn't care about us anymore. However, all of this fighting and forgiving, shouting and staying, has taught me a lot about God in recent years, too. It's almost as if this same path I've walked with Isaac has been mirrored with me and my Heavenly Father. It's been common over the last decade for me to want to drive away from God, too. The battle's lost, the dream's broken, the loved one's buried. It's all become too much, too hard. Why would a God who loves me take away so much that I love most? Why have I been to more funerals of people under 20 than over it? Why would God fill me with a desire, hear thousands of my prayers about that very thing, and then let them go unanswered? Why would he ask me to step out in something and then go rogue silent? Where I can't see his provision or even feel I can hear him anymore. For longer than I care to admit, I bit off on the belief that I was the forgotten one, the unloved, the left behind. The failures I had experienced in my businesses, the ministry I ran, and my relationships created a perfect storm of mistrust in the one who formed me from dust. It didn't seem that my daddy God was protecting my heart the way I wanted, or perceived he would, and I almost didn't recover from the grief of it all. I became convinced that my unfavorable circumstances were intimately tied to being forgotten and unworthy of good things, and the lie that I wasn't loved enough to be protected nearly swallowed me whole. Somehow, in the battlefield of my emotions, I mustered up the courage to stay. I held on to him anyways, even though it was just the very tip of my pinky finger some days. Deep down, I knew I wasn't forgotten, even if I couldn't convince my heart to feel the same way. I hung on anyway. I chose to stay anyway. And as I started to examine God's character and study the lives of men and women of faith in His Word, I discovered I wasn't alone in this feeling of abandonment. Some people who were highly favored in the eyes of the Lord experienced severe prison years before they ever entered into the Promised Land. The story of Joseph has particularly gripped my heart as I've read through the betrayals and hurts outlined in Genesis. A boy, highly favored by his father, ends up betrayed by his own brothers, sold into slavery, and imprisoned wrongfully for many years. All of this unfolded while he was trying to live upright and honorably. The Bible never mentions Joseph's sin as a trigger for these consequences, and only speaks of how he stewarded his slavery and imprisonment. It is in these years where I can only imagine how Joseph must have felt trapped, isolated, and forsaken. I can't fathom how lonely he must have felt in that prison cell, how confused he must have been by how differently his life looked from the dreams he had as a boy. But God's timeline was different for him, and it's different for us too. It was in these desolate years that God was doing some of his deepest work as he cultivated Joseph's heart and prepared him to carry out his promises. It's stories like these, and also my own, that have brought to my understanding that we must pass through a process before we can live in the promise. Without suffering, how can we know joy? Without overcoming betrayals, how can we know true forgiveness? If we never have the opportunity to walk away, how could we possibly understand what it means to stay, to fight, to live wholly and truly? And I've come to think that's the point of all this heartache. All of these detours, broken dreams, and failures we experience along the way really are gifts. God knows the goodness that comes on the other side of it all. He knows the fullness of experiencing true joy and true forgiveness and true love, and what we need to walk through to be able to drink it all in. He knows that if we just choose to trust Him, if we just choose to stay, we will come to know and understand pieces of Him that are only available through time and tending. And I think we will come to find that those exact treasures we discover in Him are the tools we desperately needed to carry out pieces of our calling. It's the secrets we uncover through tattered hearts and wrinkled hands that give us strength to keep clinging to each other through the storms. If we keep choosing Him, we will get to experience the wonder and magic of this beautiful, priceless old love. And we will get to do it with Him. Chapter 6. Reach out. It is perfectly okay to admit that you are not okay. Anonymous. Yesterday was one of those days where I started to question whether or not I would survive this whole motherhood thing. As an introvert, constantly being needed by kids and clients and friends and family, all while running several businesses, was wearing me thin. I could feel myself bubbling up to the brink of an unhealthy breakdown. I pictured myself as an old cartoon character turning red all the way up my body, then my neck and my face, until I was shaking with smoke and steam bursting from my ears. In times like these, I have come face to face with the fact that I have clearly neglected my own heart and am hovering dangerously close on a mommy explosion. I think all of us find ourselves here at some point, mother or not, business owner or not, where the demands of life and lists and loved ones take over the care of our own souls and send us barreling into the very worst versions of ourselves. On this particular day, though, my overwhelm was specifically tied to my need to be alone. And the tiny humans who shared my space didn't understand this deep need of their highly fraud-functional introvert mama. Fraud-functional is a word I've made up to define my life most days. I'm functioning, sure, but barely. Dinner is made, the kids are clothed, kind of, and I'm pretty sure I'm carrying on conversations or at least answering questions, but I'm not connecting. My heart is a million miles away, retreating into a safe place while my face glazes over and nods at the incessant demands that come with raising a family and running a home. In this space, I stop laughing, or even smiling for that matter, and for me that's a huge, flashing red light that something is severely wrong. Everything feels like a weight, and joy and peace seem nowhere to be found. I started to feel my insides tremble in frustration and my breathing change, and I realized I had a choice in how the story continued to play out. Would I continue pressing on when burnout, and let's face it, explosive mommy was looming? Would I let the fear of being a burden to someone else rob them of being a blessing instead? Would I insist on doing everything on my own and lose my cool in front of my kids? Or would I realize that I couldn't do this alone, call for help, and give my heart the time it needed? As a working mama, situations like this used to paralyze me. One of my biggest fears is failing on my responsibilities as a mother and having to ask for help. I have a hard time getting past the fact that these kids are my responsibility, and I don't want to burden someone else with watching them. It took me a long time to realize other people didn't feel burdened by my children, and actually, my letting go and reaching out was a blessing to them too. Thinking my children were a burden for others and solely my responsibility was a lie I had made up in my own head and placed on other people that simply held no truth. So last night, as the smoke of frustration was rising up and clouding my brain, I stopped, and I chose to reach out instead. I asked a friend to come over and stay with my kids for no other reason than to save me from losing my absolute mind. When my friend got there, I got in the car and drove straight to a nearby lake. I didn't turn on a radio or a podcast or anything else to fill my mind and rob me of the silence I desperately needed. I rolled down the windows and let the wind tangle my hair. I used one hand to drive and the other to surf the breeze out my window, and it felt like the most needed therapy. When I arrived, I walked around the lake at the slowest pace humanly possible. I breathed in the summer air and watched the sailboats glide across the water as high schoolers sat chatting on the shore. I had time to think and breathe and pray and dream. And for the first time in a really long time, I actually felt like me again. Value can't be placed on time like that. Time to be refreshed from the inside, to be filled up by the very voice that spoke us into being. It's priceless and necessary, and oftentimes, especially for us women, it's one of the first things we say we can do without, but we can't. We need each other, friend. We just can't do this alone. Even God created in Trinity. He paved the way for us to do life in community by being community first. But sometimes we need to get out of our own way and past our own fears and let it actually happen. We need to breathe in, let go of the lies we've let in, and allow the people who love us to really love us, tangibly. Honestly, we need to get over ourselves. We need to be okay with help and realize that our best selves emerge when we admit we can't do everything, or at least do everything well. There have been times over the course of our marriage when we've been rich in friendships and community, and there have been times when we celebrated our birthdays all alone. I know what it's like on both sides of the fence. And can I just say that finally finding a group of friends that feels like your own home is worth every awkward effort and uncomfortable invitation you may have to walk through to find. Early in our marriage, shortly after moving back home to Oregon from Florida, Isaac and I got a bit bummed out because we discovered that some of our friends were hanging out without us. And now that we have so much social media, this is something I'm sure all of us encounter and struggle through at times. All of the thoughts began to swirl in our minds about how they must not like us anymore, or that we had been replaced, or that maybe we weren't even fun people in the first place. We felt bad for ourselves for a good solid while before it dawned on me. Well, someone had to invite the other, I said to my husband. Someone had to make those plans and make the calls and set out to do something. If we want friends like that, then we need to go be friends like that. With that one revelation, my whole perspective on all of this shifted. And I began to put the weight of cultivating friendships on myself instead of blaming others for not loving me like I wanted. And that shift changed everything in this area. The friends and community conversation is a difficult one for some. I get that. And if you've been left, burned, betrayed, or lied to, it's all the more difficult to get back in the game. I get that too. Truly, I do. But it's worth fighting for, friend. You can't do this alone. You really can't. So if you're waiting for someone to call or text you, call or text them instead. If you wish someone would invite you out for coffee, be the one to invite someone else out for coffee. If you are all alone on New Year's Eve and you wish you had somewhere to go or someone to kiss at midnight, plan a party and give everyone, especially you, a fun place to belong. It's much harder to place the responsibility for how our lives look on ourselves than it is to complain. It's much easier to throw a pity party for one than host a real party for a handful. But the best things in life are very, very rarely the easy things. And those things that seem difficult or hard or even impossible, pressing through with those things is where we find the gold. My encouragement to you, dear listener, is to be the invitation to someone else. Chances are extremely high you're not the only one wishing you had someone to hang out with, or a place to go, or a party to attend. So reach out, send that text, make that dinner, plan that thing, and be the answer to someone else's prayer. Chapter 7 12:3:1 Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. Proverbs 4:23 As I've opened my ears to hear the cries of our culture, I'm struck by the very sense of isolation and disconnectedness we all seem to be enduring. In a day and age where we can be connected to someone at any second of the day, it feels as though what really matters, the in-person, heart-to-hearts, and circles of accountability, are dwindling at an alarming pace. People are constantly talking, but rarely connecting. Everyone feels they have the right to speak into the lives of everyone else, and I'm constantly shocked at the things people say to one another behind the safety of their screens. Since I highly doubt that you, precious listener, are laying into people online, I want to talk for just a minute about